I'm talking about the corporate war machine, the military-industrial complex. I'm not saying that all corporations are bad or even that big money is necessarily bad, but I'm saying that it has been bad in the past, and people better be pretty careful of the direction the country's going and also how the corporations are indeed controlling the government.
And why shouldn't they have a voice in protecting their interests?
I'm not saying they should not, but I think the corporations have come to a point where they're literally dominating the political landscape and the direction of this country. There is a balance there. And the balance has been tremendously skewed in the directions of big money and big corporations. And we need to rein in the corporations. There's organizations out there that are trying to reestablish this balance. There's a balance between individual freedom and corporations and government. And I'm just saying it's very, very skewed.
What organization is trying to rein in the corporations?
POCLAD, P-O-C-L-A-D .org or .com. You can look them up.
POCLAD. I mean, are they doing a good job at this?
They're doing the best they can. There's
Are you anti-WTO?
World Trade Organization?
Yeah.
I imagine there's some parts of it that are probably okay. There certainly needs to be cooperation among the planet and the countries and so forth. But I'd say the WTO and NAFTA and GATT and the rest of them are basically a corporate takeover of the planet and not in the best interest of the average person.
I would say, from what I look at the website of the WTO, and I think about organizations trying to establish more legitimate pattern for international trade, that I don't see where that's bad. I think the WTO is like an economic UN. I think what people were protesting in Seattle was they were looking for a party.
Well, I think that's a far cry from what most people are protesting.
I think that nothing came out of Seattle other than disruption. I think that when we look at the civil rights movement, we can name many, many names of leaders that came out of that movement. We can't name one leader that came out of Seattle. It was a crackpot, disheveled excuse for not having your act together.
Well, I guess we can take this, we're getting near the end of the program here, but maybe we can take up the WTO and talk about it and decide on the airwaves here, as much as we can do such a thing, as whether it is in the best interest of the average person, not only in this country, but on the planet as well.
I don't really think that's the issue. The issue, in my opinion, would be do organizations, corporations, big organizations, economic organizations, have the right to gather together and peaceably assemble.
Well, they certainly do, but do they have the right to be as decided by the Supreme Court in 1886 that they are indeed persons? Remember that, I don't know if you heard earlier in the show where I talked about what that basically allowed corporations to do is that you could have some CEO do anything he wants, pollute the streams and do all kinds of nefarious activity, but then be excused because the corporation would take the punishment, not him.
Well, I mean, we have immunity for public officials. So if we're going to talk about liability for corporations, let's also talk about immunity for public officials. But I'll just say this, the WTO is nothing more than an economic United Nations. There's nothing wrong with economic organizations getting together and peaceably assembling.
Okay, that's your opinion, and we will disagree at this point.
Thank you much.
Sure enough.
You bet.
Well, we've approached the end of our show. Jeannie, I wish I could get you on here, but we only have 5 seconds. So I'll be back next Monday at 7 o'clock. Thank you. This is Tom Clooney.
Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you're out there across America, why, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. Because this evening we have Dr. Mike Geyer and his son on the line. Now, Dr. Mark has a PhD and an MD, and he, of course, has written a number of articles on vaccines, and, of course, their good and their bad effects. And he certainly doesn't feel that we shouldn't have any vaccines, but he feels that if we have vaccines, they ought to be as safe as possible, and they should tell the American people the truth, and they certainly ought to take the mercury out of the vaccines when it isn't necessary, and yet they haven't done it. They're lying, as they always do, but then the average American isn't smart enough to realize that because somebody says something doesn't mean it's the case all the time. And then, of course, Dr. Geyer's son's going to be on with us. So who do we have on the line right now?
Hi, this is Dr. Geyer.
Okay, fine. Thank you so very much. Is your son with us?
You were going to call him on the other line?
All right, fine. All right, I'll have them call him right now. I'll get Ed to go ahead. Ed, if you would mind calling on that a line and just add, instead of 8-8, make it 8-9, if you would, please. And we'll get Dr. Geyer's son on the other line, and we can talk. Now, is your son into medicine as well as you are?
Yes, he's a graduate student at the National Institutes of Health.
All right, fine. So why don't you basically tell us... Ed, you're going to have to go, I think, to line one or line two. You can't use that line. All right, fine. Well, as far as your background, why don't you sort of introduce yourself to our listeners? I know about you, but they don't. You are actually spending almost full time just researching and studying and writing papers dealing with the vaccine issues and similar issues?
No, actually, I spend about half my time doing that, and the other half, I'm a prenatal geneticist. I do amniocentesis, genetic counseling, sonography, and genetic work on women that have a family history of breast cancer.
All right, fine. Well, I think that's really so vitally important. So, well, why don't you sort of get off into what's happening as far as the vaccines? Let's just take some of the issues. There has been many people have expressed concern because of the shocking increase in the rate of autism in America. And it's said that, you know, here in California, it's been up some 600% in the last, 10 or 20 years. Of course, some people want to say, well, that's just because they're better at picking it up. But this really isn't the case. What about the incidence of autism, and what is its relationship to the mercurials and the other products that we've been putting in the vaccines that we've been forcibly giving to our children?
Well, my first reaction when I heard about the autism problem was, just like everybody else, that it must be overcounted or new diagnoses or something like that. But there are many, many sources now that show that autism really is up, and it's up in a very epidemic way. The rate of autism 20 years ago was somewhere around 2 per 10,000, I mean. And currently, it's somewhere around 1 in 250 to 1 in 300.
It was 2 to 10,000, 2 in 10,000, and now it's 1 in 250?
Yeah, depending on who you read. And it's been confirmed in a number of places. The most recent is in JAMA, the Journal of AMA, the most recent journal article, again confirms that autism is really an epidemic form. Now, when I first began to realize that this was occurring and someone suggested it might be due to the mercury in the vaccines, my initial reaction was, gee, maybe it's due to, you know, people watching more television. I mean, how can you say that? So I was really a doubter when I first started into looking into this. But we had a very strong, my son and I had a very strong background in studying the adverse reactions of the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. This is a system in 1990 which came into effect in which the U.S. Congress passed a law that said that all adverse reactions that occur following vaccines had to be reported to the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia. and they keep this in a database, and we analyze the database. So we began to analyze the database to see if indeed people who received vaccines that contained mercury had a higher rate of autism. And early on, since a lot of vaccines had the mercury, it was hard to do the analysis because everybody had the vaccine, everybody had mercury, and how could you tell? But in the later years, it turns out that some of the DTaP vaccines, which is one of the common vaccines given to children, it's for diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis. Some companies made that with mercury, and some companies made it without mercury. Now, the interesting thing about that is that they were, whether you had the vaccine with mercury or without mercury, was given in the same schedule at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. And so we started looking at the adverse reactions specifically of autism and of other mental retardation kinds of things. And we found that there was a much higher rate among reported among children who had taken the vaccine, the vaccines that had mercury, as opposed to the ones that didn't. Now, we didn't just, you know, go from that and say, well, that proves that it was the mercury in the vaccine. We started doing more intensive investigations, and we started saying, well, maybe those reactions are either overreported because people realize there's mercury in the vaccine and they're mad, and so they report more, or the doctors are upset and they report more, or maybe the vaccines themselves are better. Maybe the company that doesn't use mercury makes a better vaccine. So we studied the acute reactions, you know, fever, pain, all that kind of thing, because if there was overreporting, then those would be up. And we found that everything was the same between the two vaccines, except for the autism and for the mental retardation. So
now, of course, this is because, of course, assuming that the contention is right, is because mercury is extremely toxic to the brain, isn't it?
That's right. But we still weren't totally convinced, although we wrote a paper on this, which was accepted. It hasn't come out, but it will come out in this summer. And we began to look at other sources for information. And maybe I'll let my son comment on the other one.
Fine. Now, what's your son's name?
David.
Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. Why don't you tell us about the other paper you're working on?
What we've done since then is we were interested in knowing if there was a dose response to how much mercury a child received from the thimerosal contained in their vaccines and how much neurodevelopmental disorders there was. And so what we did is we looked at the individual doses and the incidence of neurodevelopmental disorders following thimerosal-containing DTaP vaccines in comparison to thimerosal-free DTaP vaccines.
Now, for our listeners out there, that's diphtheria, tetanus, and then acellular pertussis or cellular pertussis, is that right?
Acellular
pertussis, right.
Yeah, which is whooping cough.
Right.
And we showed on a graph that basically the distributions follow an exponential distribution. That means that as the amount of mercury increased, the incidence of neurodevelopmental disorders following thimerosal-containing vaccines increased faster and faster and faster. This is very indicative of a pharmacokinetic curve showing that there's probably causation between the adverse reaction and the vaccine. We've also recently analyzed the U.S. Department of Education's report on various conditions in school-aged children. And what we showed is that autism and speech disorders followed the same exponential pattern in children with increasing doses of mercury from the vaccines that they received.
All right. Now, basically, would this have to do with the number of vaccines that they got, or was there varying amounts of mercury in the various different vaccines?
Well, see, there were two different ways of looking at it. When we looked at our VAERS data, we were looking at children that had one type of vaccine, that is the one with mercury, compared to the ones without mercury. When we looked at the education department's data, we were looking at how many shots they received.
All right, fine. So basically, there certainly were certain of the DPT vaccines that didn't have any mercury, and there were other that did, and the ones that had the mercury, the children did far worse than the ones that did not have mercury. Is that, in essence, what you found?
Yeah, but more specifically, they only did far worse with regard to neurodevelopmental disorders.
Yeah, we've plotted out the incidence of these of more acute reactions following the dose of mercury, and we found no relationship between increasing mercury in the incidence of these conditions. So, for example, fever doesn't matter. Yeah, fever won't increase with increasing doses of mercury. It stays the same or doesn't follow any particular
path. So this is a control to show that, the mercury is doing exactly what you'd expect it to do biologically. It's neurotoxic, but it doesn't cause the other problems.
Now, of course, there are other problems that some people have suggested might be related to vaccines, such as diabetes, type 1 diabetes, and autoimmune disease, and allergies, and asthma, but those weren't increased at all in this group of children. It was just the neuropsychiatric problems?
Well, we haven't really analyzed those. The other condition we analyzed was heart disease, actually. We read an article in the New England Journal that came out several weeks ago that correlated increasing mercury concentrations actually from fish and an increased risk of heart disease in adults.
Now, of course, we've known that to be true in the Japanese for a long period of time, but is that true here in America as well?
Well, what we looked at it following the childhood vaccine, the increasing doses of mercury, and we saw the same effect as with the neurodevelopmental disorder.
Now, what sort of cardiac problems then do they have?
We looked at specifically heart arrest.
Okay. But heart arrest, you know, in small children, is this really a bunch of a problem?
Well, it doesn't happen in a lot of children, but it happens a lot more in the children that have the mercury in the vaccines than the ones that don't have the mercury in the vaccines. We also looked at, so we're giving you various evidence of why we became convinced that autism went up with the mercury in the vaccines. We also got a hold of a report done by
the
CDC on their data using the VSD data. Now, they used a different set than we did. We used the VAERS data. They use data that comes from a private contract they have with the Kaiser groups. And their interim report had the same thing that we found. As the children had more and more mercury shots, and they were actually able to track each shot because in the Kaiser system, it's all computerized. But as they found more and more mercury shots, more and more autism.
All right, so when we're talking about a devastating assault on our children, now, certainly, is this why we see now in the Homeland Security Bill them putting in a provision that you can't sue Eli Lilly, and of course, why this very, in fact, the administration tried to seal all of the information that was brought up in lawsuits against the fund that they have, the government fund for vaccine damage. They tried to sue that, pardon me, to seal all that information so that other plaintiffs would not be able to get it. Other parents who'd had children who were damaged would not be able to get that. And then, of course, apparently they backed down on that because of the public uproar. In other words, there was nothing to conceal. Why were they concealing it?
Well, we actually have spent a good deal of our time appearing on behalf of petitioners before the Vaccine Compensation Act. And up until that Homeland Security Bill, the Act did not cover thimerosal or mercury in vaccines. It covered children that had DTP and had seizure disorders and all sorts of things, but not thimerosal. It turns out that thimerosal was made by Eli Lilly, and it turns out that the chairman of Eli Lilly was on the group that the advisory panel that drafted the Homeland Security Act. And the Act actually requires that the children who claim to be damaged by thimerosal have to go to the Act. It doesn't mean actually eventually that Eli Lilly can't be sued, because the Vaccine Compensation Act has provision that if you go there and you're in the Act for 280 days, you can withdraw. You can also wait until you get a judgment. If you don't like the judgment, you can withdraw. When you withdraw, you're then able to sue whoever you like. In this case, it may be the vaccine manufacturers. And interestingly, it may be Eli Lilly, which is an interesting situation because they're not the vaccine manufacturers. Companies that make vaccines, Eli Lilly hasn't made vaccines since the middle 70s. But what they do is they make the preservative. And so other companies make a vaccine, and they buy the preservative from Eli Lilly and put it in their vaccine. And if they were sitting here, they would say, gee, they bought the preservative from Eli Lilly, and Eli Lilly says the preservative is absolutely safe.
Well, now, of course, aren't there a lot of other preservatives other than mercury that are used in vaccines that are not harmful to children?
There are about at least 1,000 preservatives that can be used. Preservatives always have an inherent potential problem because they're there to kill bacteria, and therefore they may have toxicity. And however, I think the use of the mercury preservative is the worst choice. But it brings up an interesting point. Why do you need preservatives at all in vaccines? Vaccines are sterile. So So preservatives are there to prevent bacterial growth, and the material is already sterile. And the answer is, you don't need any preservatives in vaccines unless you put them in multi-dose vials. And the idea there, FDA is afraid that if it comes in a vial where you pull out 10 different shots, that some nurse or some health professional will inadvertently contaminate it on the first dose, and then have contamination on the other doses. So they require a preservative in multi-dose vials. On the other hand, you can certainly make vaccines in single-dose vials, in which case you need no preservative at all. And the additional cost of going from multi-dose vials to single-dose vials, pennies. And that, in my view, that's the obvious solution. That way we don't have to worry about any preservative.
All right, fine. Well, of course, this really is a great human tragedy because, of course, when a child becomes autistic, it just destroys the family in many cases. The whole family centers around this child. They have certainly behavioral disorders and functional disorders. Have you looked at all into the fact that some of these children can be improved by being treated to try to get the mercury out of their system?
There are a couple of doctors who are doing non-traditional treatment of chelation. Chelation is a process by which chemicals that bind heavy metals are used to try to remove the heavy metals, in this case mercury, from the children. I wish them luck. I don't know whether it really works. I know there are stories that things work, but of course, sometimes children get better with autism anyway. I wish these groups well, and I wish they would publish more on it. But I still think that, we don't have much to offer these children in traditional medicine, standard medicine. So, it's maybe reasonably worth an attempt. But I think that the damage that's been done is incalculable. At first you think, well, gee, it's a few children, it's a shame. But it's not a few children.
We're talking one in 250.
It turns out to be about 20,000, roughly 20,000 children a year. And this has been going on probably since the 1930s, but in large extent, it's been going on, say, since 1990. So there might be, from that, just a rough guess, that we, if this is really true, that we have iatrogenically affected, that means inadvertently by doctor or medical, intervention, 200,000 children.
No, of course, the thing is that no doctor would willingly do anything to harm a child. This whole thing gets around to the government regulation that requires the dimerosal or the mercury in multi-dose vials, and of course they encourage multi-dose vials because they're just a little bit cheaper. And so in the name of helping our children, several hundred thousand of the damage. What about ADH and ADHD? Are these real entities, and is there any relationship between the mercury and that sort of reaction?
Well, we don't have a good way to take it apart. I think they're certainly real entities, and I think they're part of the autistic syndrome.
All right.
The way our database codes them, we don't have a good way to look at them in detail. This is all very new information in a certain sense. In an old sense, there have been, since 1967, over 1,500 articles published on the damages by thimerosal. So that's not new. But what's new is this epidemiological data that shows that it's more likely than not due to the mercury. Now, those were things like case reports. Somebody got mercury, there was damage. So I think this is all new, and in fact, the first publication of this will be in the summer.
Well, now, the interesting thing is you speak of the 1,500 scientific and, I suppose, mostly peer-reviewed articles that show that the mercury, the thimerosal, is dangerous. Is there one that shows it's not dangerous to justify continue using it?
Yeah, there's one.
There is one.
That's the one that Eli Lilly based its original reports on, and it's really very weak. Even that one basically says there may be damage.
They say there may be damage, and that's the one that they base their report on. That would be the grossest of malpractice.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of malpractice. Not interesting in the sense that, the damage, if you calculate 200,000 kids, and you figure that each kid maybe is damaged, $500,000 or something, I mean, just as a conservative estimate of what the damage is, you end up with trillions of dollars.
Uh-huh.
I mean, beyond amounts beyond which any company could ever possibly repay. It's a simple arithmetic. 200,000 times you know, a million is a trillion.
Now, of course, we're seeing all sorts of articles in the media now saying, look, of course, it's really very important what the Congress did. It was very clever that they got this through the Office of Homeland Security, because, of course, we have to protect our vaccine manufacturers, because, of course, we don't protect our vaccine manufacturers. Nobody's going to produce vaccines. And then, of course, think of all the diseases there will be. And, of course, you know, so it's good that we protect the vaccine manufacturers so they can continue manufacturing the vaccines. But nobody ever points out that a vaccine manufacturer shouldn't be protected if they are knowingly harming our children.
Additionally, this is not a vaccine manufacturer.
All right.
Lilly hasn't made a vaccine in, I don't know, 28 years.
But, of course, they don't bring that out. In other words, they alter the truth, and it's a technique known as sophistry, where you argue a false point to the point where it comes to be accepted as truth, even though it's a lie. And they are so effective in the media doing that sort of thing. Well, is there anything else we should bring out as far as mercury? Because I think your work certainly will be seminal and vitally important in this whole argument.
Well, we didn't talk about actually the doses that children receive.
Okay, let's get into that, because, of course, the toxicity is dose-related, isn't it?
Yes. It's important to realize that the U.S. Government has set limits as to how much mercury children can be exposed to on a daily basis. The Environmental Protection Agency has established a limit of 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per day for the oral, which is oral ingestion of methylmercury. And we've been doing calculations to give you an idea. You take an average 2-month-old child. They receive 25 micrograms of mercury from their DPT shot, 25 micrograms from their Haemophilus influenza or Hib vaccine, and 12.5 micrograms of mercury from their hepatitis B vaccine.
Oh, no, that's actually the hepatitis B vaccine was forcibly given in the nursery to newborns, you know, before they even got out of the nursery.
Well this is it's given at birth and at 2 months.
Right.
So they get, between all these different vaccines, they're getting, the average child gets about 62.5 micrograms of mercury.
And yet, of course, the maximum allowable dose is 1/10 of a microgram?
Per kilogram per day.
Right.
So, you know, you take an average-sized 2-month-old child, and they're allowed, you know, they weigh, what, 7 kilograms, be a fair estimate? So they're allowed 0.7 micrograms.
But, of course, they're giving this all at one time, and this is the thing, and they bunch all of these vaccines together, you know, because it's more convenient, especially in the big clinics like Kaiser. They like to give them maybe 6 different vaccines at one time, you know, so we just get them in and get them out, mass production.
But as David was saying, that's almost 100 times the maximum dose.
Well, of course, now there has been a recent study that's been put out that to try to say, oh, there's nothing to worry about. We've checked these children. We've checked their urine levels of mercury, and we've checked their blood levels. And we want to assure you, we want to assure the parents of America that we're from the, there's nothing to worry about. Now, you've actually analyzed that study, haven't you?
Yes.
Would you like to explain to our listeners your analysis, what you found as you looked at this study?
I believe on the issue of whether thimerosal and mercury cause damage in children, this study has nothing to offer.
But, of course, it's presented in the media as the definitive study. In other words, basically, what did they do? Didn't they actually test the urinary excretion levels? That has nothing to do with the amount of mercury in the brain.
Well, first of all, they tested the blood levels and urinary excretion and fecal excretion, and they tested it at random times, usually between 10 and 25 days after the shot was given. Well, first of all, they almost want you to conclude that the child didn't get mercury, but we know the child got mercury because it was in the vaccine. So if it's not in the urine and it's not in the blood and it was in the child, the fear is that it's in the brain, and they didn't measure it in the brain. Of course, in reality, a lot of it was excreted. They didn't look at the blood early enough. If they looked at the blood on the first day, there would have been a lot in the blood. But even if they had done that, that wouldn't have proved that it's damaging or not damaging. All they're proving is he gave 25 micrograms of mercury. There's 25 micrograms of mercury around. Their study really doesn't address the problem at all. It doesn't say at all in any way whether it causes damage or not. And if anything, it makes me feel less confident. I would have rather had them said that they found the 25 micrograms in the blood So I know it wasn't the brain, but we know the brain from various other studies. The brain accumulates at least 5 times more mercury than any other organ in the body.
And it passes the blood-brain barrier and gets right on into the nervous system. My understanding, it goes to the very, very sensitive levels in the brain, you know, the areas where a cognitive and a motor function is centered.
Yes, and by the way, the study is very poorly done. I mean, they just took random time.
Well, now, was there any relationship between the people who did this study and the vaccine manufacturers that are trying to cover their tails?
That's unknown. But let me tell you more about the cumulative dose, though.
All right.
We said it was 100 times for one shot at two, or I mean for the average child of 2 months. When you add up the whole schedule from birth all the way to 5 years, the average child has three or 400 times the permissible dose for oral, and oral ingestion is far less of it is absorbed into the body than via an injection.
Now, it's interesting that the FDA and CDC agree that the children get more dose than is permissible by the standards, but they say only somewhat more dose. And here's what they do. They take the dose at 6 months, and they divide, they say 6-month-old is 180 days old, so they divide by 180, and they find that they're over, but they're only over 2 or 3 times. But you see, that doesn't make any sense. As I said when I testified before Congress, I'm 54 years old. And if you gave me a lethal dose of mercury and divided it over my 54 years, I wouldn't be over at all. I'd also be dead. You can't divide by that. I mean, those levels are maximum daily permissible levels. The fact that they had nothing on some days doesn't undo the fact that they had very high levels on other days. Also, as you mentioned, the child that's given their shot on day one of birth, they have nothing to divide by, and there's nothing they can do about it. They're massively over. So they're trying to sort of ameliorate it, and the truth of the matter is that they were asleep at the switch, as some of their own memos show. They didn't realize that there was so much over what the permissible doses were, and they should have done something a long time ago.
Well, now, of course, isn't one of the biggest problems that in recent years, in the name of course, helping our children, the medical authorities and the American Academy of Orthopedics and the whole medical establishment has been actually encouraging more and more and more vaccines. It used to be that, you know, a child got, you know, DPT and, you know, a polio shot, that was it. I mean, and then, of course, we come along with the MMR and the chickenpox and the hepatitis B and the Hib. And isn't it simply a matter of simply overload from so many different vaccines?
It may be true, but also remember, this is something that's sort of been pulled on the vaccine researchers as well. They make a vaccine, and they analyze the safety of the vaccine, and maybe it's pretty good, and it does a lot of good. And then at the last minute, unbeknownst to them, the company comes along and adds mercury as a preservative and throws it in the vial.
Right.
So they, you know, when they were doing the research on it, they weren't making multi-dose vials, and they weren't adding mercury. So in a way, it's not the vaccines, it's the cumulative dose of the mercury that's becoming overwhelmingly high.
And of course, that part of this is the government requirement that they put the preservative into the multi-dose vial.
Or permitting the multi-dose vial.
Right. And of course, but then nobody in government wants to ever admit that they've made a mistake, and they all want to, of course, retire and go to work for the drug companies, as some of them unfortunately do.
You know, there's another problem, another big source of mercury injection. And this is one, remember I told you that what I do when I'm not doing this is I'm an obstetrical geneticist. So I do amniocentesis. And when I do amniocentesis on a woman who's Rh negative, I give her a Rogam shot. And the Rogam shot is to prevent immunization against her own fetus. And unbeknownst to me, up until a couple years ago, the Rogam shots contained large amounts of mercury. And now I was exposing not only the women, but I was exposing the fetus.
Don't feel bad. When I was an orthopedist, I used to give my patients fluoride, you know, because we were told that was good for defeating osteoporosis. So, you know, we're trapped in a system, and sometimes, you know, we listen to what they say in the big centers without ever analyzing all the implications. And I know neither you nor I would ever want to do anybody any harm. We do our best, but we need to get the truth out. We'll be right back here. We got a 3-minute break, and then we'll open up our lines to callers. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there in the listening audience, we do hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day as we are on radio and internet, 3 hours on satellite, 2 hours on shortwave. Our weekend program is now heard on 36 stations, as well as, of course, a new program we're going to be doing in the Monterey Bay area on one of the larger stations here at noon every Saturday and right following the Saturday special on KSCO. So we hope that many of you out there will decide right now you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us, because what we do is an expensive proposition. But then you're not going to get so much of this information from other sources, and how privileged we are to have guests like we have tonight who are experts in the field and are simply giving you the scientific facts about what's going on to help you make a decision as to whether you're going to look after your child's health or you're going to make somebody else make those decisions for you, people being flawed and many times making some serious mistakes. So if you believe in Radio Liberty, if you believe, as I do, that we are involved not only in a crisis as far as medicine and finances and government and our relationship to government, but we're involved in a spiritual battle, which is being fought on a political and ideological battlefield, even on a medical battlefield. If you believe that there are real problems that are beyond the scope necessarily of science, we hope that many of you will decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, you know, you can do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, you will certainly be glad, that we'd be glad to send you a free copy of our latest newsletter. The December newsletter deals with finances. The background to America's financial programs that we have, the Federal Reserve System, where did it come from? What are the central banks? How do they interlock together? Why did they do away with the gold system that worked and take us into a fiat money system, and what's going to happen? Well, it's all covered in our latest December newsletter, which we'll be glad to send you free of charge. If you haven't had a previous letter, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you a copy of that newsletter, and we'll help you prepare for the very, very difficult times that lie ahead. And certainly, if you're not prepared for those times, why, you may very well find that everything you've worked for during your entire life, your pension, your annuities, your insurance policies, indeed your bonds, everything in dollar increments can be lost when a monetary system begins to fail. So give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. Remember our website, it's www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And we certainly suggest you go there, pull down our back newsletters, listen to our programs there 5 hours a day, and you won't get anything accomplished, but you'll have an awful lot of knowledge. And then, of course, please remember to pray for our ministry, for our provision and protection. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Mark Geyer, his son, Dr. Mark Geyer, and his son, David Geyer, and we're talking about the mercury that's been in the vaccines. And do you really feel that because we've been getting so many more vaccines recently, do you think that's why we're seeing so much more in the way of autism, the skyrocketing levels?
Yeah, I think that's really what's happening. I think that, you know, there probably was some minor damage done to my generation. I mean, I got DPT with whole cell DPT, but I only got a few shots, and I was over the maximum, but I wasn't so over the maximum. And the amount has been growing and growing. And interestingly enough, in testimony before Congress, the FDA said that, you know, perhaps there's a problem, and perhaps they should have done something before, but after all, they've removed all the mercury now as of the year 2001.
But that isn't true, is it?
But that isn't true. We went home and looked in our PDRs, and now just recently, 2 days ago, we got the 2003 PDR, and there's still full doses of mercury. In fact, my son can tell you which.
In acellular DPT, DTAP manufactured by Adventist Pasteur has 25 micrograms. Hepatitis B manufactured by Merck has 12.5 micrograms. And Haemophilus influenza type B manufactured by Wyeth has 25 micrograms. In addition, now influenza's vaccine is being recommended for an ever-increasing portion of the pediatric population.
and that also has 25 micrograms of mercury.
So the FDA is not telling the truth, in essence. They tell us what we want to hear, but the truth of the matter is, if you don't look at the label insert, you're not going to know what's in that vaccine.
Right. And in fact, this is something where parents can actually make a difference, because they can go and they can insist now, since there are some vaccines that are appropriate for children that do not have mercury, they can insist that they get a vaccine that has no mercury. And in fact, they need to get the doctor to bring them the package insert to read, because we've heard many parents go to the doctor, and these doctors are well-meaning, and in fact, you know, I want to make it clear, I think vaccines are good, and so do the doctors. But the doctors will say, well, don't worry about it, it's been removed. But if you get them to bring the package insert, we hear many stories where the doctor says, my God, it's still in this one. Yes, it's still in this one. So look at the package insert of the vaccine your child is getting and make sure it does not have any mercury in it.
Well, we have heard that the vaccine manufacturers have said, well, yeah, we'll take it out, but we want to use up the stocks we already have on hand. After all, we can't just throw away these stocks.
Well, they said that, and that was the story in 2001, but it's 2003, and the stocks aren't good for that long. They're still making it.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that the FDA actually in 1999 issued the statement saying that Thimerosal should be withdrawn from all childhood vaccines. And then in 2001, the Institute of Medicine issued a report on Thimerosal and said that the U.S. vaccine manufacturers were capable of removing the Thimerosal and that only a few remaining doses, in their opinion, were still on the shelves. And here we are in 2003. And the physician's desk reference, PDR, clearly shows that the new vaccines in there have Thimerosal in many cases.
Okay, fine. Well, now, is there anything else we should bring out about the mercury? Because I want to get into the hepatitis B vaccine and my concern about this being given to children, you know, in our society where this is not a major problem. It's a major problem over in China, certainly with over 700 million Chinese having had hepatitis B and 120 million current active cases in communist China. But certainly, why are we giving hepatitis B to our children here in the United States where it's 60 to 80 bucks a shot when it really isn't necessary?
Well, I'm glad you picked hepatitis B, because we have, I think, over 10 publications on hepatitis B. That happens to be one of the vaccines that we've looked at very heavily.
All right, fine. What about this problem of molecular mimicking? The gene seems to mimic the lining of the protein or the whatever it is in the myelin sheath.
Well, I think we have to start out with understanding something about hepatitis B vaccine. There are various vaccines in the last 15 years that were available that you have a lot of reason to believe would have problems, like whole cell DPT. The pertussis portion of the whooping cough portion of the whole cell, which is no longer available. That one really has been withdrawn in the U.S. You took the whole organism, you killed it, and you gave it. So there were lots of poisons in there, and it wasn't surprising that there were all kinds of adverse reactions. But with hepatitis B, if you read the package insert, it says it's a single antigen, genetically engineered, highly purified vaccine. So you would think that it wouldn't have any reactions. And in fact, this is another one where I got duped. I run a laboratory that does chromosome analysis to go with my genetic work. And because the laboratory workers work with blood products and other human products, I was giving some of them hepatitis B shots. And they knew that I worked on vaccines, and they said, well, you know, is this a vaccine that has no reactions? And I said, gee, you know, it's the ultra-pure, ultra-modern vaccine. It should have no reactions.
Don't feel bad. I did the same thing with my staff.
Well,
and I took it myself, and I now have a peripheral neuritis. It's very... a progressive, but go ahead.
Well, anyway, we started looking at it in theirs. This was the first vaccine we actually looked at carefully within the vaccine adverse events reporting system, and it had more reactions reported than virtually any other vaccine that we'd seen.
Now, here is one we were told was completely safe. It's you know, it's genetically manufactured, and yet it's having more reactions than any other vaccine ever reported. So why?
It is more complicated than that, than just looking at the total reaction report. You do have to, what we did is we've broken it down by adults and children. And actually what we found is that the adults seem to have very large number of reactions.
Now what sort of reactions?
They appear to be autoimmune in nature. They can, things like myelitis, neuritis, vasculitis.
So a lot of people get progressive peripheral neuritis is basically you're saying.
Yeah, or arthritis.
Right.
Well, a good description for a layperson, that their entire body starts to fall apart. Everything fails. Memory fails, kidneys fail, muscles fail, nerves fail.
And you see all different degrees of it. And the interesting thing is that we looked at it and we saw a heavy preponderance of females, which is, of course, often seen in autoimmunity. And so we said, it's an autoimmune disorder. We're not so sure about that anymore because we've looked into this in much more detail. And first of all, we asked the question, remember I told you this is a genetically engineered, single antigen, highly purified vaccine. That's a quote from the package insert. It's genetically engineered, I'll agree with that, because they take the gene and they put it in yeast. Single antigen and highly purified turn out to be not quite so true, because it turns out that there's a lot of yeast proteins present. And in addition to being female, females tend to have more autoimmune disease. Here's another suggestion. Females tend to have yeast infections, and they become allergic to yeast. And so we started looking into the testing. You know, another interesting question is, how could they do the testing on this vaccine and find almost no reaction? When we start using it, there are a lot of reactions. So we found out that when they do the testing, they were testing people to see if they were allergic to yeast. And guess what? If they had a skin test that was allergic to yeast, they excluded them from the test.
Well, that sounds to me like basically what they were doing was coming up with a preconceived a plan. They knew there was going to be allergy to yeast, and so by skin testing the people and then excluding all of them, why, of course, and then when they give it to the general population, they don't skin test them ahead of time. That sounds to me like they knew there was a problem, and they were going to simply rig the study so that they would get the result they wanted. That isn't scientific at all. That's dishonest.
Well, the package insert is very careful. If you read the fine print, it says if you're allergic to the mercury in the vaccine or the yeast in the vaccine or any other component of the vaccine, you shouldn't give the vaccine.
Yeah, but how do you know the doctor isn't told that? I mean, there's not one in this. I've never heard that before about yeast, or that you should be tested beforehand to make sure you're not allergic to the components of the vaccine. That's simply to cover them, but certainly that is not commonly known.
It didn't quite say you should be tested. It said if you're allergic. In other words, you're right. You're absolutely right. People who are allergic to yeast normally don't know they're allergic to yeast,
right.
So they take the vaccine. And that explains why when they did the safety trial for this, there were not many reactions, but there are more reactions now. And this is really a tricky thing, because that may be an alternate explanation of why females react more than males. It could still be the autoimmune, but it could also be due to the yeast.
And let me bring up about the mercury. As an adult, you receive in hepatitis B 25 micrograms of mercury, which when you do these computed out, you're probably the average person's probably 6-7 times over the EPA limit for the maximal permissible dose of mercury. So that may also contribute.
And of course, that's oral. This is actually being given IM, so, it's a much, much higher level.
Yes, that's right.
And you have a series, it's given every couple of months,
right.
1 year.
They're really overloading mercury very quickly. The hepatitis B to adults is given every 2 months for 3 months, and then usually another shot after that. So you get quite a bit of mercury in that as well.
Well, let me just ask you the ultimate question: why are we mandating this for our newborn children when this is not a factor? I mean, if mother has hepatitis B, yes, but that isn't a very common thing. You have to check her ahead of time. You could tell whether she has or not. Why are we giving it to all of our children?
I don't have a good answer.
I do.
All right, go ahead.
The reason it's being given to children is hepatitis B is true. It isn't as common as it is in China, for instance. It is a fairly common disease in the United States, and it is one of the leading causes of hepatocarcinoma.
Yeah, but if you're only going to get this if you're sexually promiscuous, if you are homosexual and an IV drug user, I mean, that's how you get this, unless maybe you're a doctor and you get covered with blood all the time. I mean, this is a disease that is related to activity and behavior.
But they're trying to, the easiest way to kill off the disease, eradicate it, is to vaccinate everybody. The initial recommendations for hepatitis B were in the high-risk adults to try to somewhat quell the amount of hepatitis B, and they didn't see there wasn't a very large decrease in hepatitis B in the general population. So in order to bring down that big number, they felt they needed to vaccinate everybody. That was the only way you could get enough protection among people to stop the transmission of the disease. And if you look at the CDC numbers, there has been some question raised, but now that we've been vaccinating all children, the numbers have dramatically fallen of the number of people that have hepatitis C disease.
There's another issue behind this, and that is, right or wrong, it's well known that children are captive, and you can get them to be vaccinated. In other words, you may well be right. Actually, there are two risk times for most people. There's birth, in case the mother has hepatitis B positive, and you may know that or you may not, so there may make some sense to give some protection at birth, although, of course, that's the time when the mercury level is highest because the child is smallest. But then there's very little hepatitis B in childhood until, as you say, you become, you know, a teenager. And so you might make the case that you could give one at birth, and then you ought to boost it as a teenage. But the teenage work in vaccines has been very unreliable because they can't make the children come in. You know, the only way they make you take the vaccine, whether they should or shouldn't make you take the vaccine, the way they make you take the vaccine is they won't let you in school unless you've had the vaccines they want you to have. They've had very little luck in let's say you're going to, you know, vaccinate 17-year-olds. So this is true not just in hepatitis B. This is true in a whole lot of places that they feel they have a captive audience. There's a more important issue, which is it's not clear that the immunity you get as a child protects you when you're 17. That's not known.
Well, of course, it sounds to me like this is a gigantic social experiment using our children, as the victims.
Well, you know, in defense, the hepatitis B reaction rate in children isn't so bad. It's mostly bad in adults. But that's an interesting thing, too. We did a study, and so did the CDC do a study. And we looked overall at the childhood reaction rates. And, you know, per million of shots, it wasn't terrible. But we found out that there were two companies that make hepatitis B for children. And one company had eight times the reaction rate of the other. When you average them together, they weren't too bad. If you got rid of the one with the eight times, it would be very good.
Okay, now what basically...
But I can't tell you which company.
Well, but what...
And you know why?
Right.
That's an interesting point. We have some people inside the CDC who have been nice enough to give us the number of doses given by each company. You can't just, you know, count up how many reactions. Let's say we're Company A and Company B, okay? Let's say Company B has more reactions than Company A. Maybe just they give out more shots. So in order to make the statement that I made, you need to know how many shots are given each year by each company. And we were given that information. But we were given that information only if we agreed not to identify which company is which, which we agreed to because we needed the information. But we feel this is very unfair to the American consuming public. I mean, you know...
Why didn't the CDC do what was logical and shut down the one company and let the other company continue manufacturing it? Are they so concerned about the not stepping on anybody's corporate toes that they're willing to harm our children in the process? If one company has eight times the number of reactions as the other one, I mean, that's a frightening thing to think of.
It's sort of like they test the cars, you know, they crash test them, and they tell you that, you know, some cars are much worse than others, but we're not going to tell you which ones are which.
Right.
I mean, it's that kind of thing, but they claim that it's proprietary. The information was supplied by the company, and they had to agree with the company not to release it. So we haven't released it, but they wouldn't have to shut down that company. All they'd have to do is allow the publication. And, you know, as you mentioned, all the doctors want to help the children. No doctor would use the bad company. But they don't allow the publication. They published it with A and B. We broke the code, and now, of course, we have the information to calculate it ourselves. But and we are able to use, you know, you notice when I told you the story about thimerosal, I didn't tell you which company there either. For the same reason. However, for the purpose of studying whether thimerosal, you know, increases problems, it didn't matter which company. But in the case of what we're talking about now, it would matter. So I believe that the consumers are entitled to know, and they should publish rates company by company. But as I said, we're not permitted to do that, and we're among the very few people they've even released the information to do the calculation. And of course, if we violate that rule, then they won't tell us anymore, and we won't be able to do the studies anymore.
Well, of course, but in the end result, certainly the children are what it's all about, and of course, you would expect the government would do what was responsible, and then obviously not doing it. Why not? Why aren't they stopping? You know, if a doctor in the hospital has eight times as many infections as another doctor who's a surgeon, why are they going to investigate that doctor? They're going to culture him from one end to the other. And, you know, and find out why he has so many more infections. What are the government doing? And, of course, they'll pull that doctor's privileges until they're sure that he's not a danger. Why is it that a doctor can have be limited in part of his practice, but a vaccine manufacturer can't be limited when they're harming people?
Yeah, I agree that they should be. And the way we strike back is, every time we publish a paper using that data, we make the statement that I just said to you, that we're not allowed to because of their, you know, and we feel that they should be allowed to.
But where is the outcry from Congress? You mean it's sort of deafening in its silence?
I'll give you an example about Congress. Congress has for years wanted the number of doses. They just want the number of doses of each of the vaccines for each year. And they've inquired and inquired, and they've never gotten it. So Congress can't even get to what we've gotten. So why they don't react more sharply to that, I don't know why. But we seem to be actually ahead of everybody on the curve. We have breakdowns, like my dad said, by year for every vaccine and by company for every year for every vaccine.
And incidentally, there's one more level that we've been trying to get, and that is, for a long time it's been known or believed that certain batches of vaccines, certain lots, are what's called, are called hot lots. And in fact, during the 1980s, the FDA had a hot lot list. And so when we search the VAERS database, we can search a lot number, and we can find that, let's say, lot number one has 10 times the reactions of lot number two. But don't jump to the conclusion that lot number one is 10 times worse, because we don't know how many doses there were in lot number one versus lot number two. The FDA has this information. The FDA and CDC have the information. They've published that they have the information, but they won't release it, so nobody can look at to see whether there are hot lots or not.
Now, my understanding is that certain of these cases of so-called battered baby or shaken baby syndrome are directly related to vaccines. The child has a shot. Child, you know, a day or so later falls into a coma. They analyze the brain and there's hemorrhages, petechial hemorrhages, and they say, obviously this is a shaken baby, you know, somebody's going to prison. And that there are instances where people have been sent to prison for shaken baby syndrome when it was a vaccine reaction. Have you heard that?
I not only have heard it, I believe I'm the only expert who's ever testified in a case and won. And I say that not boastingly, because when I got into working with vaccines, my goal was, and still is, to try to get these vaccines, which I think are crucial and very important to the American public, to be improved and to be open so that we all understand what's going on and we can all work together. But I never dreamt that I would be called for a criminal case. And when I'm called for a criminal case, I have nightmares, because I don't think any of us want to see children abused. And, you know, you ask yourself, was it a vaccine reaction, or did the person abuse the child? And so I was called for a case in New Jersey, and the child had received a DPT shot on the day in which they accused the father of shaking the child. And there was no broken bones, there was no bruising, there was no witnesses, there was no previous history. And so I went to the case, and they asked me, Dr. Geyer, what do you think happened to this child? And I said, you know, frankly, I don't know. I don't know if the person shook the baby or not. But before you put the person away for life, I think you ought to know that in this particular lot, there were 20 other children that had a similar kind of reaction or a similar sounding kind of reaction. That doesn't mean he didn't shake it. But, you know, I think before you put the guy away, you should be aware of that. And it ended up that raised a reasonable doubt in the jury's mind. And I hope I didn't get a guilty person off. But it's a really scary thing to see when you know, their experts had said, well, it almost never happens, you know, and here I came with 20 shots, and the prosecuting attorney, interestingly enough, tried to attack me by saying, well, you know, Dr. Geyer, all you need, all a parent needs to report to the VAERS is a phone number. And I said, no, they need something else. And the attorney said, what? And I said, a child that seems to be adversely affected by a vaccine. People don't sit there and, you know, make phone calls for nothing. I mean, the database is a reasonable database, but it's scary, because here's an interesting scenario that really bothers me. What if, you know, this is with the old-style DPT, and therefore the old-style DPT had endotoxin and it could cause bleeding. It also causes uncontrollable crying. 11% of the children who used to get this old vaccine used to cry, and you couldn't stop them from crying. They'd cry in a high-pitched manner. It's called a neurological cry. It's probably related to slight swelling in the brain. Most of those kids are fine later. But what if a child were crying, and the father goes over and picks up the kid and, you know, holds him gently, and he keeps crying. And then he tries to feed him, and he keeps crying. And then he tries to, you know, comfort him. And then he tries to change his diaper. Then he gets mad, and he shakes the kid. You know, Was that due to the vaccine, or was that due to the father being unreasonable? It really worries me. This is an area that, you know, since we don't have a crystal ball, I don't think anybody wants to get a guilty person off. And yet, when it happens on the day of a vaccine, especially when it was a whole-cell VPT vaccine, and when there's no other evidence, I mean, usually if you use a child, there's broken bones, there's witnesses, there's previous history, there's bruises, there's something. I think you have to have at least a reasonable doubt as to the story.
Well, Chris, the thing that disturbs me is I think that there are people in prison today for killing their children who children actually had a reaction to the vaccine. And because the public health authorities have such a vested interest in the vaccinations, they're not about to admit that children die of these vaccines with the petechial hemorrhages and all of these things that the picture, well, pathologically, you can't differentiate whether it's vaccine or a shaken baby, can you?
Well, that's
invariably.
You can't tell with any certainty either way. But let me tell you, after doing that case and after having the person win, I got sent a whole slew of cases. And some of them were unbelievable. They had the vaccine, you know, 3 weeks earlier. The kid has 4 different broken bones, bruises. People saw him hitting the kid, and they say, well, get me off because my child was vaccinated. Well, you know, I don't think anybody wants to get off the real abusers either. But it is scary, the thought that a parent could suffer the dual loss of a child in which they did nothing, you know, criminally wrong, and now they go to jail for it.
Well, these are the things, issues that maybe we can explore at a great length. But unfortunately, the hour has just flown by. I want to thank David and certainly Dr. Geyer both for being with us this evening. And I hope we can get you back on some of our other programs. As you know, we do 5 hours a day, and we're always looking for experts. And you are certainly the leading expert on this subject I've run into. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us, and we'd be happy to come on another time to talk about other vaccine issues.
God bless you both. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great Northwest and thank them, of course, for being with us. And, of course, we'll be back again tomorrow at the same time. Until then, please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if American people don't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on this country. And we ask you, of course, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for our ministry, our Radio Liberty, for our staff, and for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being because we have with us a very special guest. His name is Randy Pyle, and Randy is a missionary in Kosovo. We had him on about a year ago, and he was home on leave. And he's back again now. Randy, how are you doing tonight?
Fantastic. Glad to be here.
Well, now, how long have you been over in Kosovo?
Let's see. We moved there in 2000 after the refugees returned, so it'll be almost 3 years.
All right, fine. Of course, these were the Muslims who left the area. Now, what's happened? Are the Serbians still there, or they've been driven out?
Well, actually, there are several enclaves. There's villages that are surrounded by K4 troops, that's K-Force, NATO troops, different troops, Italians in one zone, Germans in another, and they have to pretty much supply those residents with food and water.
Well, why do they have to supply them with food and water?
Well, it's the problem with the Balkans is that they have long memories, and revenge is a cyclic thing that usually lasts about 500 years at a shot.
Well, of course, this is because, of course, the Muslim invasion of that area, and of course, that half the population is Muslim and half of it is Christian, and there have been atrocities on both sides for the centuries.
Well, actually, there was this more recent one was okay. If you go back to 500 years, sure, the Turks came into Europe. They weren't driven quite out of Illyricum or that coast south of the Serbs. And more recently, well, back in 13, what was it?
Well, the 1682 was a great battle outside of Vienna. Of course, if the Christians hadn't held there, why, we'd all be speaking Muslim today. But I'll always be speaking Arabic.
Yes, yeah, actually in the Balkans area, Kosovo area, which is supposedly the cradle of civilization for the Serbs, around 610 AD.
Okay.
but in 1389, the Serbs were driven out, and they remember the Battle of Polje, where they lost so many people. It's called the Field of the Blackbirds because they lost so many, and they'd always wanted to get it back. And in 1999. Slobodan Milosevic was able to switch his focus from Bosnia and Croatia down south and invade under the guise that he was driving out terrorists, which ended up in Albania, where we were. We were able to find out that most of them were children and women, not terrorists at all. We followed them back in and helped them start rebuilding in 2000. The population was 90%. Kosovo Albanian, 10% Serbian. Beograd used to manage the Kosovo province, especially after Tito died. Then it swung more into Serbian hands, and they had all the managers. About 10% of the population were managers of factories in Kosovo, police, and so on.
Whereas, in other words, these were the Serbians, and the rest were Muslims, and so you had a 90% Muslim majority and a 10% Serbian minority controlling them?
Yeah, roughly 90% Albanian. Now, among those Albanians, you did have they'd be Muslim and Catholic Albanians, but they're all driven out. These are nominal. They aren't fundamentalist. They don't know. They don't read the Quran. They don't know. They're Albanians, and their ancestors, their grandfathers and great-grandfathers were, had to embrace Islam because they were converted from Catholicism.
Basically. Well, they had to. Didn't they tell them more or less, you convert or we'll kill you?
Well, at the point of the sword, Islam has been known to try to convert. And, of course, during the Crusades, there was a backlash from the Catholic Church against Islam. using the sword, so it became more politicized than religion.
Okay, so but basically it got to be a power structure there in Kosovo then, is what you're saying?
Well, it ended up that after the communists came in, and actually it was 1913 that boundaries were redrawn. Europe moved in, and Kosovo, Albania had its own independence in 1918, I believe, somewhere around there, and it was able to have its own language again because they began to become, you know, Albanian instead of having to speak Turkish. So you're talking about the power of communism then for 50 years once the Albanians started to get on their feet and have their own language and the government. Then the Italians came over, the fascist Mussolini, into Albania, and the Albanians were helping, you know, fighting alongside Serbs. There was, you know, different alliances. But then when communism took over, Tito had a balance between the Croatians, which were Catholic, and the Slovenians, and the Montenegrins, which were more Orthodox, and the Albanians, which were more Muslim and mixed, you know, with different groups through Macedonia. The Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, was, I forget how many provinces, all having a balance of power.
Well, of course, they had Serbia, and they had Bosnia, and they had Croatia, and was Montenegro and Albania part of that, or were they separate?
Albania was always very separate, with Enver Hoxha having his own dictatorship, and whereas Tito had his own style of communism that was more independent from the Soviet Union. Albania, Enver Hoxha really admired Stalin, and in the end was said to have founded the first totally atheist state in 1967.
But was it really an atheist state? Wasn't there still the framework of Christianity there, at least a belief in the basic Christian tenets?
Well, the foundation, yes, but they had imprisoned and actually done away with a lot of pastors and priests, Greek Orthodox and Catholic and evangelical. So it was pretty much ground zero when we went in the end of, like, 1989. We moved in 1993, and people knew nothing of Jesus or the Bible or anything. It had been pretty well eradicated. There were a few believers that would walk the streets in prayer in pairs. There was no allowed house meetings of more than, you know, 3 to 6 people. They had to have permission.
Well, now, what year was this you're talking about?
This was Albania in the 50 years of communism.
Fine.
It was very totalitarian. It was amazing.
And, of course, I'm sure they had their informants there. It was sort of like the TIPS program here in America. They tried to get in, but fortunately they didn't. So, anyway, then, of course, you went in, about year 2000 into Albania?
Well, in June of 1993, we moved into Albania.
Oh, you did? Okay.
And then 1999, we were wondering where we were headed next, because pretty much we had had just great success in what our work was, which was church planting. And it seemed that leadership, then Christianity was coming back quickly, mostly among the youth, where there was young pastors of 18 to 25 years old. So we were looking to move somewhere else. Then it came the flood of refugees in 1998, 99. And just as almost quickly they returned, as NATO started putting pressure on Beograd and the Serbian paramilitary forces within Kosovo. And we saw that the Albanians returned to their homes faster than the United Nations, UNHCR, could get them buses.
Okay, well, now, were their homes still there? Or had a lot of the homes been destroyed in the bombing and the other activities? Was there? Did the Serbians burn some of the Muslim homes?
I think they were proactively rezoning whole neighborhoods.
Well, what about the NATO bombing?
The NATO bombing was really cheered on, really just brought such relief to the Albanians. Anyone who we talk to, they have a regular, you know, festival, a day of Thanksgiving for when the NATO bombing started in Peja, the town where we're in. And they were just, because it turned the tide, and they were able to see the Serbs then start move out of Kosovo, and they could start moving back in. But they burned up to 60-80% of some villages where they felt there were strongholds of resistance. There were certain populations that wouldn't bend the knee at all. And basically, in the end, they were hoping for resistance, I believe, so that they could drive them out. This is something that started in 1985.
No, who was hoping for resistance?
I believe the Serbian forces, the Belgrade government.
You're talking about the communists now?
No, I'm talking about Slobodan Milosevic.
Well, but he was a communist, wasn't he?
I would say, well,
he was a hardline. I mean, he was certainly a follower of Tito, and he took over when Tito died.
I would say he was a flaming nationalist. He was for the Serbian. He wasn't for communism or anything. He was for the Serb blood and was interested in getting rid of, getting even, cranking his people's fervor up so that they would really get rid of, get revenge on the Albanians and drive them out.
All right, fine. So so you then went in with the Albanian refugees. Now, do you speak the language?
Well, after 10 years, yeah, we speak it. Our children are in the public school that's only in Albanian, and we do rather well with the language.
Well, now, what do you do as far as church planting? Is there any Christian movement there in Albania today?
Oh, absolutely. Actually,
I should say in Kosovo now, because now you're in the Kosovo itself.
Yeah, I follow you there. We've seen amazing coordination of missionary organizations. Right now there's about 50 organizations with personnel living in Kosovo.
Now, these are evangelical organizations of various denominations. Is that right? Are you the Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, or what?
Well, we're on the subject of evangelical church planters.
Okay, fine.
So we're speaking of Assemblies of God, Southern Baptists, Conservative Baptists, and Mennonites, and you name it. Anybody, we're a consortium of missions organizations that can work together, and we've seen about 40 or so fellowships meeting in 2002, average of about 20 adults per fellowship, and there's about 120 missionaries now working in Kosovo in this group.
Now, these are people who at least nominally were Muslims before?
Let's see. We haven't had much success with the Catholic believers, or you know, there's probably been some. There's a strong enough church there that they haven't, but we're just having the most success, I guess, with disaffected Muslims and atheists.
All right, fine. So, of course, this is a traditional Muslim population, but they're not the sort of fanatic Islam that that you might see in other countries. This is more or less nominal Mohammedan, you know, just looking for answers to life.
Yeah, as I said before, if you ask them what they believe, they'll say, well, we don't know. And we ask, do you read the Quran? And they might say, what's that?
they're not the people out there praying five times a day, and they don't have the mullahs on every corner with their towers there, call to prayer?
No, there is a movement. Finances are coming in to build more mosques at strategic places. There are a lot of missionaries coming in from Saudi Arabia. We saw a lot in from Tunisia coming into Albania before. And they're hired to, you know, get mosques going. And there's a lot of call to prayers that rings out five, six times a day from the towers of mosques. And people don't bend the knee. They don't face Mecca. They go on about their business. And they mostly observe Ramadan, where they fast for 40 days, but only during the hours of light. And they, when you ask them what the fast is for, they say it's for remembering that Abraham was provided with the lamb when he was about to kill Isaac. And so they kill a sheep, have it killed by a demon, by a priest from the mosque. And it somehow protects the family for the year. It's about as deep as it gets, as I understand.
Well, now, I think it's very interesting you say that the Saudis are spending a lot of money to build mosques there and to bring in the imams. Are they, of course, if the Saudis are sending them in, they must be preaching the Wahhabi religion, exactly as the Saudis are, of course, spending countless billions of dollars here in the United States and bringing in the radical clerics here. So is that the same thing that's happening there in Kosovo?
Well, I wouldn't single out Saudi Arabia, but certainly there's, they send in the Mujahideen type people that are very well-disciplined in Islam, and they we don't find them really friendly.
The Mujahideen, of course, are the holy warriors. They are the radical, fundamentalist Islamic people who fought in Afghanistan. But the whole idea is that they are holy warriors involved in the jihad, pursuing the cause of Islam. Is that what you're speaking of now?
Well, they wouldn't put it the jihad. Of course, they would say is the inner struggle of each Muslim, and nonviolence is part of that. So I wouldn't characterize them as being violent.
So these are not then the typical Mujahideen that we would affiliate or associate with what happened in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's probably not a good word. That's what we call them.
Okay, fine. So I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing, because when I say Mujahideen, I mean the holy warriors. These were totally dedicated. So you're just saying that these are the people coming in from that are trying to proselytize the Muslim religion, just as you are working to further the kingdom.
Yes, and
but somebody's got to put up the money for them. I mean, people don't come. You have certainly backing from people who support your missionary work. I know our church supports what you do. So who's financing these Islamic people who are there? Is the money coming from Saudi Arabia, Tunisia? Whereabouts, you think?
Well, yeah, it certainly is. I think Islam is a worldwide movement, and they would like to take advantage of the fact that it's a time of great change in Kosovo, but they have people actively encouraging the spread of Islam in all through America, and it's no different in Kosovo, except we get different characters than would come here, I suppose.
All right, fine. Well, now, who are the Christians doing better, or I should say the evangelicals, than the Muslims, as far as, because you're really vying for the souls of these people who really suffered so much in the recent years?
Well, yeah. I think there's two different modus operandi, and ours is to love people into the kingdom, and it seems that Islam has a lot to do with fear, and in one aspect, if a Christian becomes converts to Islam, we don't threaten to kill him. But if a Muslim converts to Christianity, they're in big trouble. In some nations, they have a sentence of death. That's really extreme. But in others, such as in Kosovo, they're under great duress. The family really torments them. You know, their friends make fun of them and say, oh, you're being paid to do this, to change your religion. And by changing their religion, they're seen as traitors to their country, because Islam is seen as part of their national identity, their nationhood. So that sort of thing is restrictive. Christianity is freedom. I see Islam as a kind of bondage. And, for example, we were teaching illiterate men in a gypsy village to read, and then we're going to teach their children as well. And the local imam came in, a group of them, and they said, now if you keep associating with these Christians, when you die, we're not going to come and bury you. Because, and this is important to the villagers, they need to know that they will be, the body will be taken care of, that they have a plot of land that they'll be put in. But what kind of offer is that? We're offering them to help them now in this life, and eternal life, for that matter. And you have someone coming saying, don't have any fun in this life. When you're dead, we won't come and stick you in the ground. That's kind of an inferior offer in my book, and I don't see that there's any competition. The growth of missionaries living in Kosovo, evangelicals, in the last 10 months has risen 25%. There's 34% growth in the number of meetings we had, have currently.
That's in the last six months?
Last 10 months. 56% growth in the number of believers this year. And right now the trend is a growth trend in most areas.
Well, now, of course, do you run schools? Do you actually provide health care, medical care? What are the missionaries there doing? And how are you reaching the people?
Oh, boy. We, let's see, my wife and I run sort of a guest house, and we have about 20 volunteer teams that might be coming through this next year. They come for an average of 10 days or so. We have our own base missionary people here, our team, that are able to employ these people in different ministry areas. I'm in reconstruction, so that I'm working not on large scale like United Nations projects where we're rebuilding many homes, but we target widows and orphans for those people that fell through the gaps from the United Nations efforts to help people. And we will go in and help super insulate, get a wood stove hooked up, put in bathrooms, water, heating, electricity. We have children's meetings that we do, and young people's meetings and women's meetings, and counselors can come in for trauma victims. We have men's, and women's meetings. And then men, we're trying to develop, if we can get micro-business going, buy cows and any kind of business. We have we work together enough, network with other missionaries, that we can talk about going into a whole village area and doing training of the trainees can take over, and doing development, not just giving people things. There has been a lot of aid we've given. Shipments of furniture come in and all, but we're such a small operation that we really want to introduce people to people and encourage the little people and just do something small, and it has great effect if we do it in love and not as a sort of superior outside helper. We try to really identify, speak the language, and have be pilots, be leaders of a lot of outsiders that can come in and donate their time.
Oh, no, of course, Kosovo was really sort of the heart of the, I suppose it was the Eastern Orthodox Church, would it be Eastern Orthodox or Greek Orthodox?
That would be Serbian Orthodox.
But there were all these beautiful big churches there in Kosovo. Whatever happened to all those churches? Really the tradition of the Serbian Orthodox religion.
Yeah, the oldest monastery is from the 1300s. It's in our town. There's still Serbian priest there. He's the the head bishop or cardinal of Kosovo. That's still existing. We can visit that. We take people there to visit it. But no Albanians are allowed inside, and it's protected by the Italian army. I think the second oldest might be in Dečan or Prizren. There's some beautiful monasteries, and they're not damaged.
What about the cathedrals over there?
Now, there were no cathedrals. Really, there were, you're talking about Orthodox chapels.
I've heard that many Orthodox churches were there. They're, 300-500 years of age. Were those destroyed, or are they still there?
The oldest ones are all there, except I saw one in Jakova that had been bombed. It seems like an equal amount of mosques and Orthodox chapels were hit. And there wasn't so much developed. They started building more in the last 10 years, a few chapels, and those got destroyed right away because they were more resented, I think, by the Albanians.
And by, I'm sorry, the chapels, you mean like churches, or are you speaking of Orthodox chapels?
Orthodox church, yeah, we're talking about Orthodox church,
okay, fine.
Now, the Catholic churches, the one major Catholic church and all the others around the countryside, one major one in Pea, it was untouched. It seemed to enjoy not drawing fire from the Serbs or the Kosovars, Albanians.
Okay, so other than the churches really have been preserved, because some people had suggested some of them had been very badly damaged or destroyed, but they seem to have fared fairly well then through this terrible, terrible time.
Well, the historical ones. I think they were careful about what they were destroying for the most part, except I know that there was probably some real loss of history in Jakova. It seems that one had been damaged badly. It could be restored. But some of them were cut right down to the ground in little pieces by explosives, very well calculated. Somehow they carried it off.
Well, now, what about the NATO troops? Are the NATO troops all throughout that area simply keeping the two sides apart? In other words, separating the Kosovars from the Serbian enclaves?
I guess the word simply, stop me for a minute. Nothing simple, but, yeah, basically they need to keep the peace and make sure that, like I say, they encapsulate Serbian villages. In some cases, there are Serbian villages that are Serbian-Albanian villages, and they watch them very closely, but there's been some success in, some villages weren't touched, and there was no need for even reconciliation. That's like Rahovec, I think, is one.
They're both Serbs and Albanians living there? Or?
Yeah, they never started burning each other's houses or anything, and somehow, yeah, so that's protected. Then there's actual Serbs that never left in whole villages, but all around were Albanians that were driven out, and then the armies have protected the Serbs of Serbian enclaves.
Okay, well, how are they ever going to get to the point where they don't have to have foreign troops occupying? How are you ever going to get the Serbians and the Kosovars to live together?
Absolutely the biggest question facing the whole nation there. And we're speaking of reconciliation now. Someone has to say, we made a mistake. And right now there's noises of that in Beograd. There's a progressive, there's one, someone in power now that's brought the whole Serbian people's consciousness closer to admitting perhaps there was a problem. Those are the people that surrendered Milosevic to The Hague to be tried.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you see a place like Lebanon, which was about half Christian and half Muslim, and they lived together peacefully for many years until the agitators came in from the outside and stirred this up. And now, of course, you know, they divided Beirut and everybody's fighting everybody else. But, I mean, it was not until the outside agitators came in that they flared up the age-old animosities. And somehow or other, we have to be able to live with people who look at the world differently than you do, especially either that or simply leave the area altogether.
Yeah, you can't leave the area altogether. That's the problem. That's why the U.S. didn't want to have anything to do with administrating government justice in Kosovo. They said, now, Europe, this is your backyard. We'll go in and bomb, you clean up, and get things back together. And we're still there in large numbers to keep the peace, but the United Nations has a big problem, and NATO has, of when they can pull out, because Kosovo is not it isn't its own nation. It doesn't have independence. And reconciliation, all this was caused by the poison of nationalism and ethnic hatred, somehow love has to come in
All right, we're going to have to take a three-minute break, and we're going to have to change the hearts of men, and that's what I know you're doing. Our guest is Randy Pyle. We'll be right back here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to, from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and, of course, trying to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And, of course, if you're out there and the listening audience listening to our program, we hope that many of you will decide that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours every day. 5 hours on radio, 5 hours on internet, 3 hours on satellite, 2 hours on the short way. But believe me, it's all very, very expensive, and we're really dependent upon those of you out there in the listening audience who believe there's a problem and would like to be part of our team. And fortunately, we are beginning to have more of an influence, more of an effect across America. We're getting people to understand that this is really a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield, and trying to reach other opinion makers and talk show hosts and trying to get them to understand how this all fits together. Try to get them to understand that there have been, since the beginning of time, secret organizations. And, of course, those secret organizations and secret societies are manifested by the strange emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the symbol of the ancient mystery religions. Going back to Babylon and ancient Egypt, what are they doing on the back of our dollar bill? They simply reflect the influence of the mystery religions on contemporary American society. That same emblem, incidentally, was placed on the DARPA, Admiral Poindexter's website there. They pulled it off when we began talking about it, but there you'll see the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye of Lucifer staring out at the world. And any of you who would like to see a copy of that DARPA website, of course, we'd be glad to send it to you free of charge if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, my December newsletter, that deals with the financial situation and what you're going to have to do to survive the coming economic turmoil, and that's really what the coming war with Iraq and the war, other wars that we're about to enter really are all about. And as the economy begins to progressively fail, they're not going to be able to keep it going simply with the wars, although that will be somewhat of a stimulus, but it won't solve the problem of massive debt and of fiat money irresponsibility. But of course, the chaos that will develop will be blamed on the wicked Saddam Hussein, not on the perpetrators of this, the central bankers of the world who are bringing about this move towards a new world order and, with that, a new world religion. Well, if you'd like to know more about the spiritual battle, go to our website at radioliberty.com, pull down our newsletters. Certainly feel free to pull it down and copy any of our files that are there. We do our 3 hours of talk radio on that network, on Radio Liberty Network, an hour on the American Freedom Network, an hour on the Genesis Network. And, of course, right now, of course, we encourage you to go to our website to tell others about our problems, pardon me, about our programs. You can tell them about our problems, too, but tell them about our programs, and please tell them about our website at radioliberty.com. Again, the telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America, our future, our families, and our freedom are certainly under attack here today. Well, our guest this evening is Randy Pyle, who's a missionary in Kosovo. Randy, would you like to go ahead and put out your telephone number? I know that missionaries, people like you, always certainly can use help. And what you've done is dedicate your life to trying to change the hearts of men, which is the only solution to the problems, whether it be in Kosovo, whether it be in Africa, where I lived for a time and saw the conflict between the various tribal groups and the colored and the Indians and the whites. And it was so obvious at the time, unless you change the hearts of men, you're not going to change society. So do you have a telephone number or any way people could reach your ministry?
It's area code 408-251-0722. It's my parents' phone. I'm staying here while we're in Kosovo, so please respect that as far as hours. I just wanted to say, along with what you're saying, that God really loves Albanians, and he loves Serbs as well.
Of course, and but you know, how do you get the people to understand that we're all children of God? Every person is made, you know, in the image and likeness of God, whatever the religion, whatever the color of his skin or race he might come from. And that is, of course, the only basis for the brotherhood of man. It's only the fatherhood of God that makes this possible at all. But of course, you have to reach the people, and what you're doing really is so vitally important to try to get the people to understand, you know, that this is, first of all, the only hope that they have in this life, in the next life, but the only hope there is for society is changing the hearts of people. And when America was a Christian nation, we were in an entirely different world than we are today. And of course, we're losing what we had, but at least we have people like you who are out there trying to, you know, get the information out. I was reading that in Russia, why in schools they have reading, writing, arithmetic, and religion. They can do that in Russia today. We could never do that in America, unless, of course, we were going to be talking about environmentalism and pagan religion. You can preach that in our schools, but don't you ever dare mention the name of Jesus Christ in an American public school today, or you will have the vengeance of the media and, of course, the government and the ACLU and the Supreme Court descend upon you with a tremendous furor. So, well, anyway, of course, over there, you're really free to preach religion pretty much as you see fit. What about in the schools? Can they bring religion into the schools there?
Yes, we don't distribute textbooks, except you could really... You could do a lot with Old Testament history, and it might become politically incorrect to present Jesus in the schools and all. But we do what they allow us to, and if you have a personal relationship with teachers, they allow it. They allow you to teach their children, which is amazing to me. They'll just up to ages of 18 or so, you know, they'll let just encourage their youth to come and hang out with us. And so it's the youth that are really catching fire. And we're planning on raising up missionaries that will come to America later, and when America has forgotten totally about who God is, perhaps.
Well, I'm not so sure that maybe you better start sending them in a hurry, you know, because I think that really there is an awful lot of... forgetfulness already here about what God is really all about. We've got an awful lot of we've got an awful lot of people who profess to be Christians, but you'd never know it if they were ever to be accused of being a Christian in a trial. Why there's not enough evidence to convict any of them.
Well, I've seen. I'm in San Jose, California, and it's really a melting pot. And I'm in the minority now. I've come back, and I feel really at home because I feel like a refugee. I'm a little bit behind. You know, if Starbucks is a new trend, it isn't anymore, but new things, then I feel like I have to catch up, and with prices and everything, new laws, and I'm thrown in with Chinese and Iranians and Vietnamese, and I just really enjoy it. They're so, the guy I bought a used car from, Chinese, he ends up being a believer, a brand new Christian, another man came over, worked with my dad's life insurance. He's Persian, or Iranian, I'm sorry. And he's a new believer, and he has great questions. And I just see that maybe San Jose is a potential grounds for training, getting people to go back to those nations, raising up missionaries. I'm an optimist. So,
well, you have to be. I mean, you can't be a missionary and not be an optimist.
Well,
anyway, of course, you know, so are you looking for people to come over and help you for short stints? You were talking about, you know, people come there for 10 days at a time, but what can you accomplish in 10 days?
Well, more work is accomplished in those that come, I believe, because you see life outside of the United States, and you see that Muslims are really people that are just nominally Muslims or Catholics, and... They really love Americans. They just, you know, if they want to learn English and they'd love to talk to you at a cafe, there's plenty of opportunity to have relationships, I think, and get a bigger perspective and come back. And sharing testimonies that are vital. We usually have groups that come with their own internal leadership with the goal of expanding their own ministries and experience. We have... church groups that send families with their children and elders, and they we find some places to plug all of them in for 10 days. They like to run flat out, get us really tired. We try to get them tired, and again, it's relationship. I have a strategy to introduce Christians to nominal Muslims there, so that they can really see Jesus Christ living in people instead of just theology. And we do what the Bible says, you know, we'll go and help widows. And we won't just talk, we have action too.
Well, you know, really, people see Jesus in what you do. And you know what an awesome responsibility it is for me to be behind the microphone all the time, and people know I'm a Christian. And if I, of course, say things that aren't right or overreact when somebody calls and gives us a bad time, and you know, certainly I'm not honoring the Lord. I can always be sure somebody will send me an email and say, I don't like the way you handle that caller at all. You shouldn't have done that. And sometimes they're absolutely right. We're all only human, but we certainly have an awesome responsibility, because you are a representative of our Lord there. I mean, people know you're a Christian, and of course they will interpret Christianity by what you do and how you react and how your sacrifice.
Yeah, and if we don't give it a good example that's followable, that's doable, that's something they can copy, and it has to do with loving others and reconciliation and admitting your mistakes, then they'll just get a false view. You're right. We need to be image bearers of our Creator.
Well, now, of course, you have how many children with you?
We have three. Elisa's 10, and Kevin's 8. Yvonne 6, also my parents, who are, Dad just turned 87, my mom will tell us how old she is. They come over every month, every year for two, three, 4 months, help out with the kids so that my wife Linda and I can go in two different directions with teams. And my dad comes on reconstruction, does videos of what we do, and my mom teaches women, and there's work for everyone there. We really enjoy being a family there.
So now, of course, you have regular Bible studies for the people and try to introduce them to the Word of God that way?
Are you talking about my mother?
No, I'm talking about you and your people you work with.
Yes, I work with, on our team is an Australian who is married to a Norwegian lady, a Lutheran. He's from a Bible church in Australia. His father's pastor teacher, and we have a Korean couple with three children on our team from South Korea. We've had Romanians, a Danish girl, a South African, and we have people from our teams are many different skills. The Australian is a teacher. He's doing pastoring now. For 2 years, we've been working alongside, Assemblies of God pastor, who has left all his peripheral doctrine. By the way, we work with Operation Mobilization.
What is Operation Mobilization?
You know, that's George Verver, is an evangelical optimist, and he's drafted into service youth that are ready for a short-term mission, sort of like YWAM. We're actually, Linda and I are with international teams out of Chicago that used to work in Eastern Europe a lot. We have international teams, has short-term teams and now career teams all over, planting churches and helping other national churches.
Now, how is the whole thing funded? Because it sounds like this is a pretty big operation.
Yeah, these are all individuals. Operation Mobilization is very interesting. It's really a crawl on your stomach sort of boot camp for people. They go in and live. I think they have to raise maybe. My wife would correct me if she was here. She knows because she does all the finances, but probably only $400 or $500 up to $800 a month, maybe for couples, is what comes in from their own churches and individual donors. There's no big corporation behind us or anything of finance. And we get the cheapest houses. We fix them up for teams. If we have to, we get a team house. We're trying to get a facility now to have as a Bible school and a team house and a summer camp. and a training development center. But for the last 2 years, we were able to see a fellowship come into fruition in a small town with about 10 baptized believers, a core group, with about 15 or 20 attending. And these people need training. They need the Word of God, and they need our example of us laying down our lives. What is servanthood? Not just to be a boss. Because in the Balkans, everybody would like to be, like in Chicago, like the Mafia. That's the general idea. The movies are big. Hollywood has really left its mark in people's lives over there, and they want to be a boss. If they become a Christian, they think that the best thing to be is a higher position. So we have to model Christ as much as teach his word, and have his spirit living in us in a way that loves them. And we expect to train up leaders and leave in 5 years and have them run, train churches, leave a Bible school and all that.
Yeah, so that's really the key, is to have a Bible school where you can actually train the ministers to take over and run things when you're not there.
Yeah, these Bible schools here are interesting. We don't want them coming to America because they'll get lost. We'd like to train them in country. The most effective way is to have them come for 1 week of training, and then go 2 weeks interning in a little village, put to practice what they've learned in that 1 week. After 2 weeks, come back for another week, and then a 2 weeks out, week in, week 2 weeks out. And it's developing strong leaders. They can keep enough monitoring how they're growing, because they live with them in the centers in these Bible schools.
All right, fine. So actually, you're really getting a pretty remarkable growth there in this area. What do you figure, another 3 or 4 years before you move on to a new field, or what?
Well, all we have is our experience in Albania. We were, most missionaries give up after 3 years. It's hard with the language and the different culture and the deception. You know, people can sort of, people tell you what you like to hear, sort of thing. But after 3 years, you begin to see certain people are serious. They're not just playing games to get a visa to America or something. And after 5 years, you can actually see character built in and leadership. It's phenomenal growth. I've never seen this. I've worked in France and Italy, Austria, since 1982. And in Europe, it's much colder. But these needy people are amazing. The young people are amazing.
Well, don't you really think it's the people who need something the most are the ones that are going to turn to Christianity? You know, when everything's good and comfortable, as it is in most places in Europe, most people feel they don't need Christ. When you're in a crisis situation, and whether it would be here in the United States or whether it would be over in Kosovo, in a crisis situation, people are looking for answers and are much more open to the message of the Bible than they are, you know, in the comforts of our society. In fact, I feel that probably one of the worst things that ever happened to a Christian society is the affluence we have. What would your thoughts on that be?
It's dangerous. You become comfortable and... Yeah, I forget who said it, but watch out when things look too good. If all of a sudden you're sick and something's wrong, you're not invincible, or you have a medical problem, or someone gets in a car accident, everything stops and you pretty much can only look up. And God doesn't. If we're in a crisis mode, we're in need all the time. That's probably not a bad thing. And to live overseas, we really deny ourselves a lot of the security, perhaps. But we find when we have the money and the security here, it can vanish pretty quickly with a medical problem. And I think God knows how to deal with people in whatever financial state they are. But poor people, perhaps, are much more receptive to what God can do in their life, both physically and spiritually, because of depression.
Well, we had a young man in our church, his name is Kenneth Rasmussen. I don't know if you know him at all, but Kevin, he had everything he wanted. He had a good car, a good job, buying a house, and he and his wife decided just do away with the whole thing and move off to Central America with a new tribe's mission down there. Just as happy as they can be. Not any of the material blessings that they had here, not any of the certainly the wealth that they had here, but doing something for God's kingdom. And you know, certainly that is so encouraging to know that people are willing to do that, and they begin to realize sometimes the futility of life if all we do is pursue materialism.
Yeah, I think people have to ask, what I ask myself is, how did the last 5 years of your life go? Are you happy? Are you satisfied? Do you think it was really well spent? And I don't think I was able to say that until I really totally gave my life over to God's use. And since then, I can look back and say, wow, brilliant, smashing, wonderful, lovely. Let's do more.
And Chris, you've been at this for 20 years now then, all together?
Yeah, I went out single when I was 26 years old. Actually, when I was 7 years old, I asked Jesus to come into my heart and give me his eternal salvation. But I didn't give him my life until 20 years later. When I was 26, I said, okay, I might have the Ferrari when I in a house in another 5 years, but I'm going to be burnt out in relationships and bitter and unhappy and unsatisfied. So I gave him my life, and he sent me to France on a short-term team for 2 months, Italy 2.5 years after that, for 2.5 years, and 5 years in Eastern Europe working in out of Vienna. And then I met my wife over there. She's from Chicago, and we moved. Took a year off here, moved into Albania for supposedly 4, 6, 7 years. I figured, and it ended up being about 7 years, I guess. And then 3 years in Kosovo now, and it's just been getting better and better.
Well, of course, it's, you know, your life has real meaning, and you can begin to see the effect of it. Now, what about medical care? Are the medical missionaries there? Do they have medical facilities, built into society? Or, because I suspect that, you know, there's a chronic shortage of medical care there. What sort of medical care do you have? Or is there any Christian hospitals there?
Well, there's a great variety. there's the state hospitals, which are being assisted by Italian doctors. The Italian KFOR has set up their own military hospital they make available to non-governmental organizations. We have medical people coming through a lot of times. We do small things. There's no great large evangelical hospitals that I know of. Usually it's the United Nations has set up most of those, but there are a lot of small efforts being made, mostly in for development, training of healthcare among villages and all. If we have problems ourselves, we're pretty secure. Our daughter, 10-year-old, was skating and fractured her arm. Took her to I don't know if it was K4 hospitals, local hospital. But they had all new equipment, and it was I don't know if it was 50 cents or $2 for the x-ray, and you can't get that sort of thing here. Of course, my big, we haven't had any big surgeries or any problems, but timing is everything. If you're sick, you should be in the right place at the right time.
Okay, fine. Well, now, of course, is there a need for more missionaries there at the present time, or they pretty well have plenty of missionaries at the present time?
There's need for more brothers and sisters in Christ. I would characterize it as sort of the blood of Jesus moving through his body to come over and get involved, and for their own good, and bring back refreshment here from there, bring refreshment from here to there and back again.
Okay, now if anybody would like to get in touch with Randy, the telephone number is 408-251-0722. That's 408-251-0722. And people can come for 10 days or more, I suppose, as much time as they want to put in?
Well, really, they shouldn't approach us about, individually, but if their church group. We would really like Christians. We're not like for humanitarian satisfaction of do something like Habitat for Humanity, which would be fine. But we want vital Christians. We want to introduce people who have Jesus really shining out of their lives. And if you email me at randypyle@onebox.com, it's R-E-N-D-Y-P-Y-L-E at onebox.com. I'd be glad to answer any questions about how you go about having your church group come. We expect internal leadership, your own leadership to come, and a lot of communication to set up, make sure your expectations are in line. We're going around a lot and showing things. On the 26th, we'll be in Felton, for example, at the San Lorenzo Valley Baptist Church, and giving a presentation of video and talking, trying to draft people right into our teams to come in the summertime. We have this huge house. We can take 20 people at a time. It's like a bed and breakfast with the projects and spiritual enrichment times, devotions and music. If you can play piano or drums and guitar and bass, we put together music, and you'll sing, and whatever your church can do best, that's what we want you to do.
Are there any American troops over there today in either Albania or in Kosovo?
Yeah, in Kosovo, it's one of the largest troop concentrations in the Balkans, is in Camp Bonsteel, I believe.
And this is American troops?
In Kosovo, yeah, American troops. There's a whole camp set up there with PX, and I forget how many troops, but
I think Bill Clinton said they'd be home in a year, and of course, there's been so many other things Bill Clinton said, it never quite worked out that way, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, Randy, I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and it's been a real pleasure having you, and I wish you the best of luck, and I envy you really the opportunity you have to spread the gospel. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Well, a lot of parting thoughts. I'd really trust that God knows what he's doing in the futures of people who submit their lives to his care and direction, and that Ephesians 2:10 says we are his workmanship created for good works, which he has created, he has prepared for us from the foundation of the world, that we should walk in them. So if you want to have direction for your life, have a really great, fulfilling, exciting life right into eternity, you need to check in, ask God to give you that direction.
Okay, well, God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real fascinating hour, and my best luck to you. I hope to get a chance to see you out of the church one of these nights.
Yeah, we'll see you there on the 26th. Thanks,
Good
night.
Dan. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and I just wanted you to have an opportunity to hear Randy and see what's going on over there and see that the lives really are being changed. And, of course, God does have a plan for what's going on, and each one of us has to decide what part we're going to play. So until tomorrow at the same time, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until next week at the same, I guess tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Thank you so much. Now, would you be able to be up next Monday?
I said no, yes.
All right, fine. If something comes up you can't make it, please let us know. And,
okay, I will.
Appreciate it. And that first hour was just fascinating.
Yeah, it was. Good night.
Anything exciting in your department?
No, just